Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Jackie Canterbury. Through her photography, Chris Effington reveals not just native bees, but the relationships that sustain them. A longtime advocate for pollinator habitat, Chris is a bee educator and blog writer with the Washington Native Bee Society, an iNaturalist community scientist, and a photographer documenting the fascinating lives of Washington's native bees. What began as simple observation in her garden grew into a way of sharing the hidden stories of pollinators, the flowers they depend on, the habitats they need, and the behaviors most people never really notice. For Chris, photography is a bridge connecting science, understanding, and our relationship with the natural world. So welcome, Chris, to Nature Now, and I'm going to ask you a few questions, and I'm going to start with kind of an open-ended question of why you study native bees. How did you get into this?
Well, thank you, Jackie. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to shine a light on our native bees. That is where it all began for me. Discovering their mysterious lifestyles through observation has become a full-blown obsession, and that's not saying it lightly. For me, it's never been about photographing the greatest number of bees, but about satisfying my own personal thirst for firsthand knowledge and witnessing the bee diversity, how they live, how they interact with their environment. And if it's bee season or it's sunny outside, you'll likely find me. Yeah, you'll find me out there. I'm probably got all my gear with me and I'm ready to go this afternoon.
Did you start this journey into studying native bees because of a camera?
No, I started with my native garden where I planted a bunch of native plants. And so then I started noticing what was I attracting. And I had a camera, and so then I started figuring out whether or not what the species were that I was seeing. That's how I got started with iNaturalist as well.
As well, okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned bee diversity. How many native bee species do we have here in Washington State? Is it about 500, 600?
It's about 600 native bees, maybe up to 700. They're still figuring that out. But across North America, there's 3,600 native bees and about 20,000 worldwide. So there's only about 10% of the native bees worldwide are social, like honeybees and bumblebees. Most of them are solitary females. They are building nests and provisioning their offspring all on their own. And they live really quiet, unassuming lives, which is why I find them so fascinating to photograph.
So what you're saying then are honeybees are very different than native bees.
Well, honeybees are not native. They're introduced species strictly intended for agriculture. And so there are bumblebees that are native that are also used in agriculture. And there's also managed species of native bees like leafcutter bees that are also native.
So there are
native
bumblebees that are native that are used in agriculture?
Yes.
So can absolutely you explain that a little bit?
Well, I know that they use bumblebees for greenhouses, for pollination in greenhouses. I'm not sure if they use any of the native bumblebees here in Washington for that. There is a concern when they introduce non-native species from a different region, like eastern bumblebees, and they can start to escape and then compete with our local regional species.
And then you have trouble. And, you know, most of us know about honeybees, and actually I did a really nice program a couple months ago on honeybees, two of them. There's a woman on Miristone that has a honeybee hive. But let's discuss native species or bee families we might encounter here. And it's my understanding when you said that there were 600 known species that the state of Washington really doesn't know. Did they just start documenting the number of native bees in Washington State?
Right. They established a bee atlas through the WSDA program that is citizen scientists that will have been trained to go out and collect native bees statewide. And they are discovering there's a lot of species that they didn't know about that were here in Washington. And so those are physical specimens, whereas I take photographic pictures.
And how are they different? How are physical specimens different than photographs?
Well, photographs are good to be able to give distribution information, especially if you're going to take photos and survey
with
in the
habitat.
Way I do mm-hmm. with the habitat. Mm-hmm. But the bee atlas collecting specimens, those are scientific museum quality specimens that are required to science speaks to science in that
okay.
sense.
All right. So. And do you want to talk about some of the bee families that we might encounter here?
So yeah, we have here in Washington a diverse ecoregion. So we have a vast number of choices, or not choices, but a vast number of bees that we'll see in range in the different families. I often plan trips around seeing the bees during the region in different regions. I'm always stopping at wildflowers, and especially I spot nesting behaviors in bees. You know, I will take a good amount of time to study that. But the bee families in Washington, I've encountered all of them except for one, and that is the oil bee family, which is Melittidae. And there is just one single species here in Washington. But the rest of us would likely see the other families represented, and they include 124 mining bees, which is Andrenidae, 151 digger bees, which is Apidae, 84 sweat bees, Halictidae, and 177 mason and leafcutter bees, Megachylidae, and 30 plaster and mast bees in Collectidae. These species, like I said, they're climbing with the citizen science numbers are, you know, this is what we know of at this point. That's really exciting.
And who are the citizen science volunteers with the Washington Bee Atlas?
There are anybody who learns, gets trained for this work. A lot of the same Washington Native Bee Society, where I'm a member, members are also part of the Bee Atlas, but they are separate organizations.
So did I hear you say that mapping bees has just begun in Washington State?
I think it's a couple years now,
that
it was established with a bee taxonomist who is the one that determines what species
okay.
have come in.
And then you mentioned here many of Washington bee families also include cuckoo bees.
Yes. So cuckoo bees are kleptoparasitic bees.
What's that mean?
They are where a solitary, in the solitary species, they're a solitary bee who will enter the nest of her host solitary species, and then she will lay an egg in, and her larva will kill the larva of the host, and then it eats the provision. So it's a pollen-stealing bee. So that female does not collect her own pollen for her offspring. She steals it through this method. And then there's cuckoo bumblebees, which take it even a step even further, and they actually take over the host colony and overpower them, killing the queen, but sometimes killing the queen or overpowering her, and then force the workers to raise those cuckoo offspring. And I'm really lucky to be able to see two cuckoo bumblebees species in my own garden every year, because, and I say I'm lucky because kleptoparasitic bees can sound concerning, worrisome, but
that word,
yeah, it's not what you want to think about exactly,
no.
but it does signal a very healthy, abundant host
okay.
population, which increases your feeling that there's great diversity, because when the host bee declines, so do the cuckoos.
You've described spending a lot of time looking for bees in the dirt. And just how many of our native bees are ground nesters. And what I want to say to you is yesterday I was out hiking with a friend, and he told me that this round hole, a little smaller than a dime, on the trail in the dirt was a bee nest. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what other nesting styles do they use? So they actually are ground nesters.
Right. Well, 70% of our bees are ground nesting, and solitary females build those nests, and they can build aggregations like you saw, where they're just all of them real close together, but they are solitary. Most of them are soil excavators, so they have sometimes their flat soil, and sometimes they have little turrets on top.
Okay. And so are they connected beneath the ground?
They make their own chambers. So those nesting holes at the surface are their entrances, and then their chambers could be various different styles underground. So and technically, they should not interact with each other once in the ground.
Because they are solid.
Right.
Okay. So 70% are soil excavators. And what other methods do they use?
So each species has a preferred soil type. And they have, some of them are very specialized soil nesters. They have soil materials that they only nest in. But across the board, most of them build a nest, they form a brood cell, and they provision it with nectar and pollen, which is called the bee bread. Then some of them, other than the ground nesting, which is the dominant number of the bees, they are also instead wood excavators. And that some of them are solid wood excavators. And those are ones that worry people because they are large carpenter bees into the wood and that might affect their houses. But we don't have any of those species here in Western Washington.
Okay.
But we do have small carpenter bees. A lot of small carpenter bees, and they nest in pithy stems. And I've actually encountered them at the beach a couple of times on biscuit root. And then there's more commonly everybody understands or knows about the renters, the nesters that are most familiar with people. And these are bees that use pre-existing cavities. And they might be holes in the ground or in the stone, gaps in masonry, beetle burrows, even snail shells, and nearly any man-made material that feels like a tube or hollow stem. And that's where people, when they manage their leafcutter and mason bees in their home gardens, then that's the kind of nesting condition that bee prefers.
So could you provide these man-made, human-made materials
that
you could entice them to your yard?
You can. You can do a lot of various different things that would encourage their use, but some species will be more inclined to nest, certain mason bees especially, in those nesting tubes that you can get from places.
Yes.
Yeah, like crown bees
yes.
would offer those things. And there's a whole conversation that we could go into on that one day, but I don't do that. I don't have enough experience about that.
Okay. For any of you who may be just tuning in, this is Jackie Canterbury with KPTZ's Nature Now program. I am talking with Chris Ethington about Washington's native bees. And now we're just going to turn to what are some of the most fascinating things about our native Washington bees that people might want to know.
Most of us may have once been stung by a honeybee.
Yes.
So one of the most remarkable things that, in contrast, about solitary bees is how very gentle they are. They are, most species are docile, and there are no queens, no hives, no aggression is just not part of their biology. The males can't even sting at all because they don't have a stinger. The stinger is, in the female, a modified ovipositor. But you'd have to know what male looks like and what a female looks like, and that could be a little harder to know that. But that their other interesting thing is the timing is interesting in that male species emerge from their nests earlier than females. And it could be a couple of weeks that they're on the landscape before the females. But it's following those males that actually is a way to find the females.
The female.
Yeah.
Sure.
So they're out patrolling, waiting for moments for the females to emerge. And once she does, then they mate. And then she immediately starts scouting a nest site. And she'll assess the floral host, the map, the surroundings. And then only then will she begin constructing her nests. But one of the most things I'd like people to understand is females will tend to nest where they emerge from, where their mothers nested with them. And so they'll go back to those nesting locations, not the nesting chamber. They won't likely use the same nesting chamber, but they will go to those same locations. And that is a really important fact.
That's really interesting because, you know, what I specialize is in birds, and they do the same thing.
Yeah.
Even go back to the same tree. And then the importance of that is disturbance to that area.
Right.
Because if you disturb it or if it changes, then do they go back to it? Keep going back to it?
They don't. Their instinct is to go right back to it. And the males are right there looking for the females. And even if you're shoveling right at that moment, they'll still be trying to reestablish, you know, that's all they know. So it is something that is a challenge and something that they're researching to try to
understand. And you know, what it also suggests is both birds and bees have really notable brains. because it takes brain power to be able to go back and find that same nest. I mean, half the time I don't know where my pencil is, right?
Yeah.
So to be able to do this is, that's quite amazing.
Yeah. So the other thing that solitary females also have an incredible level of control over their offspring. They decide the sex of each egg, and it is much dependent on the floral resources. If they're abundant, they will invest in fertilized eggs, and if they're scarce, they'll invest with male eggs, because males require fewer foraging trips to raise. Sometimes even females are much larger than males, and you can imagine that the males to produce that male is also less.
Is that right? So female bees,
Not all, but some
are larger than the males.
Right.
And that's
right.
The same in birds.
Right.
Very similar in some birds. The females are larger.
So in lean years, you can actually see a shift towards more males on the landscape the next year.
And a lean year would be due to changes in the habitat.
It could be resource competition. It could be that it's climate related. Okay. Or reductions in, disturbances and development of land that has changed the habitat.
Habitat loss.
Yeah. And then they don't only control the sex. They also control the placement. The females choose where in position in the nesting chamber, in the brood cell, that she places the males, because the males are in a hurry. They want to get out really fast and be on the landscape so that they can be mate for the females.
Okay.
And so if they were to be further back in the nesting brood cell, then they could disrupt a developing female, which wouldn't be the ideal.
And so a brood cell then is defined as?
A brood cell is, the nesting chamber is all of the maybe network of a bunch of brood cells. So the brood cell is that cell that has the provisions and the egg. And it depends on the species, on how it might be a single one-off on a branch, or it could be like with leaf cutters, it could be several bees laid within a tubular section and with plant material between those, separating those eggs from each other.
Thank you. We've talked about all your memorable moments with bees. So can you share a few memorable behaviors you'd observed while studying and photographing our native bees? And these are, you know, perhaps moments that have really stayed with you.
Well, I have a long history of wonderful moments, but the most dramatic one that really kind of helped shape how I shared my information was when I discovered the dune digger. And
the dune digger, meaning on the sand dunes,
right,
in Washington State, where you live.
Okay. So most bees nest in the ground and are nested below 6 inches to 3 feet and deeper. And so what we don't realize is that we're walking all over the bees all the year long, and they're all living, and they have a life cycle that's annual with 5 larval instars, just much like the butterflies, and the eggs hatch shortly after they're laid, and then they go a whole year underground before they emerge for that brief period where they fly, mate, provision, construct nests, and provision all over again.
So they're below ground for a year.
Almost a year, yeah. With just a few weeks, most solitary species are just a few weeks above ground and flying. And that's when we see them. But they're actually alive the whole time we're walking all over them the rest of the year.
And what is the impact of walking over?
It doesn't have an impact to walk over them. It has more impact if we dig into them.
Okay.
That's
using a shovel.
Right. In context to some of these behaviors that I've witnessed, the digger bee in Washington, which I discovered, was one of my first digger bees here, and it's a silver and black digger bee, and I suspected it was the Pacific dune digger, and it was at the beach. And I followed the males the next season and was starting to chart their behaviors. And then when I returned, eventually I found that defining moment, which was when the female entered a nest and exited a nest, and I got that photo.
You saw it.
And that's when they were able to confirm my estimation of it being the Pacific Dune Digger Bee. And it was important because this bee is a dune specialist that is globally imperiled. And so I was obviously very excited. And then I was able to share this discovery. I joined the Ground Nesting Bee Project on iNaturalist, which is run by the Cornell Bee Lab. Mm-hmm. And I started studying these bees year after year, seeing these patterns. And I was able to document these behaviors. And then it allowed me to set the time for the next season. And I was able to catch those moments in early season. I'm out there doing things that nobody would do. It's cold, it's windy, it's not spring like we think of. And I'm out there, you know, toughing it out and watching this behavior. And so one morning I was watching the males start to aggregate over the nesting of the dune, and I started seeing numbers that just like exploded suddenly. And these were bees that were suddenly emerged at once. And so when I saw this happening, I got very excited, and I kept coming back to where I would be able to see the females emerge, looking for that mating ball. That mating ball that this species does is 7 to 10 males at a time will pounce on that female. And so I finally came back one afternoon after I saw heated activity, and I found that the females started to emerge. And it was early, so there was like the entire hundreds of males that were on the landscape were just like on her at once. And it was wild. Wow. It was wild.
It sounds wild.
And so I had looked around and I'm like, wow, there's all this buzzing. And how could I be the only one seeing this? This right. is just not fair. Who is it? And I saw a man walking by the beach, and I said, can you want to come over here? And he came over. And one of the first things he said, which is a lot of people do ask, is, wow, are they aggressive? And
I said, oh, sting? No. Is it going to sting?
Yeah. And I said, no. I said, I was actually just moments before laying on the sand a few inches from this mating ball, one of them. I saw three in that time frame. And a few inches away with a macro and taking pictures. And the bees were bouncing off my hand. So, no, they're not aggressive.
That is really interesting. And so this was the first digger bee. Was it in the state of Washington or just in your area that you found?
This is the first bee that I found after I moved here. That right. The first digger bee, okay. And that again is in the member of a family of bees, and okay. So it's not the first time, but it is one of the largest aggregations.
So you mentioned working with Cornell University Bee Lab through iNaturalist. Can you tell us what you do as a community scientist?
Yes. Well, as we talked about, most of our bees are nesting in the ground, but their nests are really, really hard to find, which makes them really hard to protect. So that's where the project GNB comes in. And it's run by Dr. Jordan Kuhneman with the Danforth Lab at Cornell University. And it looks at how different soil characteristics influence the populations of our nesting bees. And they're understanding the exact soils and the species needs, and eventually they use that knowledge to protect, restore, and even relocate nesting aggregations. And the project relies on community scientists like me to help locate nest sites and estimate the size of these aggregations. But last year, I was able to participate with a protocol, following their protocol, to collect the sand and soil samples from the Pacific Dune Digger Bee grounds.
Yeah, that we talked about.
Yes.
Right.
And I continue to monitor that site today. But that's just one of the community science projects that I work with. But having all the photographic observations on iNaturalist
yes.
adds to the verified research grade level observations, adds to the biodiversity data that is available to researchers worldwide. And this really is the rewarding, to know that these moments that I capture are becoming field contributions to understanding a much larger data set.
So you take your incredible photographs, which are very close up, mm-hmm. and then you put them on iNaturalist, mm-hmm. and then you'll get scientists, actually, and lay people
right.
to look and verify that you did, in fact, see this specific
right.
bee. So it's all verification.
Right. It's verified mm-hmm. by a group that are experts at that. I'm not an expert at bee taxonomy, so I rely on them. And then those verified observations, which they call research grade, are then used by whomever wants to use them. And I have participated and been contacted with by a few people who have indicated that my data has become part of their research papers.
Oh, that's just incredible. Yay for science. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And the last question is going to be for home gardeners. And I thought what we'd do, and it is a part two, we're just going to sort of touch on this right now. And then when we do it again in August or September, I'd mm-hmm. like to really focus on the simple things that we can do to help native bees thrive where we live. But let's just end on, we have a couple minutes left. What can home gardeners do specifically? And I also want to note that you gave us a Wild Four Native Bees plant pick. And so this is a compilation of forage by season, and we'll have it on Instagram. So for those people that want to freshen up before we speak again, they can look on Instagram. But just for the next couple minutes, what are some of the things that we can do to help bees?
Well, I think it's important. We've talked a lot about the natural nesting in wild spaces, but we have, as gardeners, have the ability to create the high quality nesting habitat right at home. And when we do, we increase the diversity of native bees in our gardens, but we also get to see firsthand watching them live out their full life cycle. And pollinators do face significant threats. About 40% of them are at risk of extinction. And this is driven by habitat loss, pesticides, climate change, and competition for floral resources. And it's important to recognize that habitat loss isn't always dramatic, and sometimes it can look green and lush and lack true ecological value. But research shows that having 8 or more species of native plants flowering, it increases both bee diversity and abundance in our gardens. And that is very important for our generalist bumblebees, which are at the beginning of our landscape, and their colony persists all the way through to autumn.
So what we can do next time is we can talk about like the use of bark chips, the use of landscape cloth, right? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, how detrimental is it to bees?
Right.
And then we can go through some of the flowers, et cetera, that they use. And I want to thank you very much for today. This has been so enlightening, and I love your work, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie.
You're very welcome. And thanks for listening. If you missed the show, I'd like you to go to the KPTZ website under podcasts. And I want to thank our sound engineer and editor, Nora Petrich. And please go to our Instagram page for more information, particularly the incredible photographs of bees that Chris put up. There are about 8 of them, and they're absolutely glorious. And then I did a little ending music, Buzzing in Birds, on my own yard, so I hope you enjoy. Thank you very much.